In just a second, we'll start with Acts chapter 10, verse 22, just a little bit more about that. We didn't cover last time. And then we'll look at Acts chapter 10 and verse 23 and what follows. But I do want to give you some information that I have found interesting. Recently picked up a book. It's been out of print, I guess, for a little while. It was written by an attorney. I don't have a lot of books written by an attorney that are about the Bible, but this one has really caught my attention. The fella asserts in the book, and he makes, in my estimation, at least so far, a pretty good case. He makes the assertion that when you look at Luke's documents, that is, Luke and Acts, you not only have the various records that we have, but he argues, and he's seeing this through his eyes, his profession, he argues that these were intended to be legal briefs. And legal briefs to defend the Apostle Paul against the charges that he was going to face, as well as help Christians as Rome became a little more familiar with Christianity. That makes sense when you start looking at how the book of Acts is broken down. When you look at Acts chapter 1 through Acts chapter 12, you have some information about the first century church, and we've gone through a good bit of that material. When you start with Acts chapter 13 and you go through chapter 20, you have information about Paul's missionary journeys. And then when you look at what might be referred to as about the last third of Acts, Acts 20 to Acts chapter 28, you find that you have information there as far as legal proceedings against Paul. When you think about Theophilus, he also has an interesting suggestion about him. He has proposed that Theophilus may have been a pretrial investigator. We've seen some of that right now with the Supreme Court thing. You've got people going out and trying to kind of figure out what's what before they make some decisions. And that's by no means new. People have been doing that kind of thing for a long time. And that might help explain why he's referred to as most excellent Theophilus. And when you look at the book of Acts, you find that there are some questions answered that someone like Theophilus and certainly Rome would want to know. For example, who are these apostles? What are they doing? Who gave them the authority to go out and do what they were doing? And how far has their teaching spread? All those questions are answered in a very sequential order in the book of Acts. So again, maybe that had no part as far as why God wanted Luke and Acts written. But it's interesting that you have two very lengthy books that compose a significant part of the New Testament. And at least from this lawyer's perspective, again, they were written as legal briefs. So it's at least an interesting possibility to consider. And maybe we'll look at some more things that could relate to that as we continue to go through the book of Acts. All right, let's go back to Acts chapter 10 and see what we've got in verse 22. This is going to bring us down to about the end of the paragraph in the ASV. And they said, Cornelius, a centurion, a righteous man, and one that feareth God and well reported of by all the nation of the Jews, was warned of God by a holy angel to send for thee into his house and to hear words from thee. Now this is, of course, the arrival of the men. They go to the place where Peter is staying. He's with the tanner, and they ask Peter to come with them and go back to see Cornelius. One of the things that we didn't discuss last time was how they describe Cornelius. If you were Peter, and you hear these fellows give the description in verse 22, is there a word there that really might get your attention? All right, that might be one. Well, that might be another. I'm thinking righteous. If you're Peter, what are you thinking? Who's righteous? Well, nobody from the perspective of Romans 3. But if you're not a Christian, in Peter's mind, would you be righteous? Certainly not. So when these fellows show up and say, we're going to tell you about this righteous man, you kind of wonder if Peter didn't step back a little bit and say, do you know what you're saying? So sometimes people can say some things where we just know that's not right at all. Then the other quick thing that we didn't cover is this word which is translated warned in some translations or something similar to that. That's a word which often describes a divine revelation or message from God. You may remember same words being used back in Matthew chapter 2 and verse 12. There were the wise men. They were warned of God. Same word. Joseph also had a warning. Same word. That was in association with the dream. Matthew 2 and verse 22. Noah was warned by God. Hebrews 11 and verse 7. Then let me toss this out as well. The angel is described by these men as a holy angel. Cornelius saw a holy angel. Why maybe use that description? Well, okay, that's one possibility that if you have a holy angel, you would also expect that there would be some unholy, unrighteous angels. So that's perhaps part of the thought. Anything else? Do you think? Okay, what about the appearance of the angel? Sometimes people can see something and the very appearance causes them to believe. causes them to react or causes them to conclude something. If you were to move a little later into the text, you'd find in Acts chapter 10 and verse 30, the angel that appeared had bright clothing. And maybe it was the brightness that caused Cornelius to give a description that ended up making these men refer to the angel as holy. Okay, let's pick up with Acts chapter 10 and verse 23. This is brand new material. So he, that's Peter, called them in and lodged them. And on the morrow he arose and went forth with them, and certain of the brethren from Joppa accompanied him. So Peter learns, going back to verse 17, that there are these guys at the gate, and he goes down, sees what they want. Holy Spirit had instructed him in that regard, and he invites them into the house where he was staying. Now that's kind of interesting to me that, was this Peter's house? No. But it says, well, come on in. Now maybe he cleared that with a tanner first. We don't know exactly how that worked, but it's kind of interesting that Peter is the guest, and now he's saying to some people who are essentially strangers, well, hey, we've got a spot for you too. You come on in. We've mentioned before that the tanner was likely Jewish out there outside the city area, because that was not something that was appreciated by the Jews, so the tanner may have raised his eyebrows a bit. Now, take this information, and let's go over for just a second to the book of 1 Peter. Some years later, in fact, if you want to put a time in this, this is probably about 20 years later. We don't know if Peter was necessarily thinking about this event in Acts chapter 10, but he probably hadn't forgotten about it. We'll start with verse 7. That kind of is where the ASV begins in the paragraph. 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter 4, 7. But the end of all things is at hand. Be ye therefore of sound mind and sober under prayer. Above all things, being fervent in your love among yourselves, for love covers a multitude of sins. Using what? Hospitality unto one another without murmuring or without grumbling. Now, why did Peter say that? Well, Holy Spirit directed him to say that, but I can't help but wonder if maybe he's looking back on this event 20 years prior to this time and thinking, maybe there was a little grumbling. Maybe there was some grumbling among the people who received this. Maybe that was just a good general statement. Maybe all those parts had some impact. But again, kind of fascinating to consider that two decades later. Peter was certainly willing to show hospitality. These guys that came had to be Gentiles, and that was certainly commendable. Anything that you want to add or ask before we make some additional observations? Bonnie?
We take people in here, although we have different campaigns that we don't know, and we have them in our house sometimes up to a week.
Yeah.
So, and you know, and it does say brethren in that verse, and so if they're your brethren, you're trusting that everything's all right.
Right. People know what Airbnb is?
Yeah.
Most do. Well, basically, if you have part of your home that you can house people in, you can rent out that part of your home. So you kind of become like Motel 6, bed and breakfast, that kind of thing. So Teresa and I were talking about that a little on the way in this morning. And people do that, and now with some of the online reviews, that's probably a little safer than it may have been prior to the internet and so forth. But thinking about that, if you're willing to do that, in this case you're obviously being paid, but if you're willing to do that, then certainly when it comes to housing a Christian, there should be willingness to do that. But sometimes people say, well, if I'm going to get paid for it, okay, but if not, forget it. Well, that's not. We're thinking about fellow Christians or even somebody that may need some assistance, not the best attitude. Anybody else? Okay, let's go back and see what else we have here. We're not told why. Peter did not leave on the same day that the men arrived. We do know from Acts chapter 10 and verse 9, or is it Acts 11, 9, that they left on the following day. Yeah, it's 10, 9. Now, on the morrow, as they were on their journey, they drew nigh to the city. So they are there for the night. One possibility might be the lateness of the day. It might be, too, that these fellas needed something to eat, and by the time that everything got fixed up, it would have been a little late to go. We talked before about the fact, this was back when we were in Acts chapter 8, that if it got nighttime for us, we don't think so much about traveling. We've got vehicles and lights and all kinds of other things, but if you're in this day and time, in this culture, traveling at night was probably not going to be the best opportunity. We do know that as we look ahead a little bit in Acts chapter 11 and verse 12, Peter took some people with him. How many people went with Peter? Six. Now, if you're going to take six people along, it might take a little while to get them ready. You might have to go out and find them. They may have to say, well, look, we've got a couple things that we have to finish up, got to pack some things. They may not have been immediately ready to go, so that also could have helped account for the delay. We're also not told why Peter decided to take six men. Was there some guidance from the Holy Spirit? Did the Holy Spirit take some witnesses? Say, take some witnesses. Did the Holy Spirit say, take some witnesses, but didn't specify the number? There is no specific information about that. But there is, as we go back to the book of Deuteronomy, a passage which might have been lingering in Peter's mind, Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 15. I cite this because of the numbers that are used there. Somebody want to read that for us? Deuteronomy 19, verse 15. All right, Carol's got it.
A single witness shall not rise up against the man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed.
Okay, God said if you're going to confirm something, how many witnesses do you need? You need at least two, or you could have three. Well, if you take six people with you who are potential witnesses, how does that relate to Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 15? You've taken at least twice or maybe three times the number that was needed. And maybe that was the passage that Peter was thinking about. This is what the Old Testament law said. And if there are any questions about this, I will have three times a specified number of witnesses. One of the
If you look at verse 13 and read that, you know, after 12, it says that he supposedly saw an angel and it said, send men to Joppa. So that's more than
Well, that would be the people that were going to the household of where Peter was. Isn't it? Am I?
Well, yeah, 10:5 says some men, but
I mean 11.
Okay.
When you was reading chapter 11, verse 12, well, the verse after it is what I'm talking about.
Okay. Okay, let's go back and take a look. 11:12, the Spirit bade me to go with them, making no distinction. And these six brethren also accompanied me and entered into the man's house. And he told us how he'd seen the angel standing in his house, saying, send to Joppa and fetch Simon, who is surnamed Peter.
Oh, my God. Mine says send men to Joppa.
Okay. Well, but even if it says send men, who's the person in this case who's doing the sending? It would be Cornelius as he's sending people to the household. And then now Peter is ready to go back and see Cornelius, and Peter decides to take the six guys. So we do have multiple men coming, and that must have been quite a delegation. So some have wondered if maybe there have been some somewhat wild speculations, like Cornelius may have sent some animals, maybe like an extra horse for Peter, and didn't anticipate that Peter might be coming back with some extra guys, so they've got one horse. But so I can say, who knows if there were any animals sent or not, but we did say as far as the distance, you could cover this within 2 days, so however it worked, they could have walked it and been perfectly fine. Anybody else? Okay, let's go back and offer a practical lesson or two. Would you say that Peter, at this point, has been willing to extend his comfort zone? I would say so. I mean, he's in a stranger's house, says to the stranger, that is the tenor, we need to house these guys, and he's willing to, you know, spend the night there in the house with them. He's surely there, willing to have them eat the food that they're eating and possibly be at the same table, and then the next day he's going to go and actually see this Gentile. So he knows that he's got specific authorization from the Holy Spirit, Acts chapter 10 and verse 19, but these would have been items that he was naturally not inclined to do. Picking up now with Acts chapter 10, verses 24 to 26, and on the morrow they entered into Caesarea, and Cornelius was waiting for them, having called together his kinsmen and his near friends. And when it came to pass that Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter raised him up, saying, stand up, I myself also am a man. Now, the information that we have in Acts 10, 24 through 29 is not going to be found in Acts 11. I have mentioned before that some of the details are found in both. Sometimes it's helpful by comparing the details. You can pick up some additional points. But here's a place where we have to restrict our study to Acts chapter 10. The information that we have here is important because it contains some really helpful information. You have this delegation of six with Peter. They've left Joppa. They're headed to Cornelius, Caesarea, and they come the next day. attention is immediately turned to Cornelius. The Bible says, what was true for this man? What's he doing? Out there plowing in the field? He's watching for him. He's waiting for Cornelius. The word which is translated waiting or something similar in your translation, I'll give you the quote here, often has the sense of expecting or waiting. Sometimes the waiting is in hope. Sometimes the waiting is in fear with the overtone of tension or suspense. And here it is a present tense verb. So if you can think about some times in your life where you were waiting, well let me just throw that out as a question. Think about some times where people are waiting in a suspenseful way for someone or for some news. What are those times? Examples of them. Okay, there's maybe suspenseful expectation for the soldier to come back and, you know, hopefully mom and the kids are in town or dad and the kids are in town, depending on which gender has been put overseas. So there's that. What else? That suspenseful expectation, good or bad?
Waiting for the birth of a child.
All right, good. Thinking about the birth of a child. Right, is everything going to go well? And maybe there's a little bit of fear, a little bit of trepidation there. Trace? Yeah, somebody's making a trip, you're looking forward to that, maybe haven't seen them for a long period of time, and they're saying we'll possibly be there between, you know, these hours around supper time, those kinds of things.
Possibly bad medical news.
All right, person has some tests, and doctor says it could be this, I think it's this, or I'm hoping it's not this. We'll let you know as soon as we get the news. Monday, by 9 o'clock, you should receive a phone call. People are sweating it until they finally get that information. Gary?
I was thinking a similar thing. If a family member's been in a crash and they're in the ER and you're waiting for the doctor to come out and tell you how bad it is, but then body made me think also people that are firefighters or police officers, their spouses at home and they know something going on. Is my husband going to come home today? Is my wife going to come home today?
Yeah. A lot of different good illustrations, Ray. You have one?
I was thinking, you apply for a job and okay, you've got the job, but we got to do a background search on you. Mm-hmm. It'll take 2 or 3 days, so we'll get back to you in 3 days.
Yeah, or to vary that a little bit, we've got two candidates that we've narrowed things down to, and you're one of the two. And you really want the job. It's kind of like, well, how's that going to go? The word's also used back in Acts chapter 3 and verse 5. This is one more way that you see it used. And he gave heed unto them. This is the beggar at the temple gate. And he gave heed unto them, expecting to receive something from them. So there's the suspenseful thing. It's like a child. Again, it's been a long time, I guess, since I was in that category. But the child is trying to sell something, chocolate bars or grass seed or whatever it might be. Or I guess probably not grass seed, but some kind of vegetable. And the child comes up, do you want to buy it? Well, probably not. But I'm not sure that that's necessarily the right answer. But the child is hopeful. There is that expectation that here's a potential customer. And I'm hoping that there is going to be a sale. So anyway, that's the feeling, that's the attitude, the emotion that was going through the mind of Cornelius. So Cornelius did have faith that Peter would come. Doesn't seem like he was thinking, well, I wonder if he's going to show up or not. He had faith in the angel. He had faith in the men that sent him. And had apparently some faith in Peter. He also had some faith in what Peter was going to say. So who does he call together? He brings together his family, his relatives, plus his friends. The word that is used to describe the friends would be the intimate associates. He gets the people who are the nearest, the dearest, the people who are the closest to him so that they can hear the gospel. Well, we're not told why he chose that group, but if humanity is any good gauge, why would he have selected those people? All right. Well, he did. That, I think, we can say for 100% certainty. Can we add anything to that? Why choose those people?
He wanted them to hear what he's going to hear so that they can back it up or
okay.
Witness it. Or
all right. I think those are good answers as well. Anything else?
They were close enough that he had the confidence that this would all come together without big disturbance or whatever.
Okay, that too, but anything else? Steve?
It would be the same as him praying and giving alms to. They may have been doing the same things he's doing.
Okay, that's possible too. Any other answer, which in my mind seems pretty obvious, but apparently not to some others? What about the people you love the most? What do you want for them? The worst or the best? The best. And if you've got a holy angel that shows up and says, hey, there's a message that I have for you, and it's good news. Your prayers, your alms, they've been heard before God, and I'm going to send you a special messenger. Who do you want to call? The people that you love the most. And I think that has got to be part of the answer. He wanted the nearest and dearest people to him to come and also participate in this experience. Can you imagine what would have happened had this happened? And then he doesn't call these people. And afterwards, he goes out and starts telling his relatives and his best friends. What would they be saying to him? Why didn't you call me? I mean, this wasn't late on at the last minute. You had time to go ahead and let us know this was coming, at least 4 days or so. So I think that has to be factored in. Okay, we're not told if any Jews were in the group, but we do know certainly some Gentiles should have been there if those were his family members and certainly some of his friends. We're also not told how many people assembled at this day and time, but we are going to see the word many, so it sounds like there were quite a few. When you look at God's timing and providence, bearing in mind that word that we haven't seen quite yet, he calls together many of his friends and family members. I'm wondering a little bit, how were they all able to assemble? People have jobs. People have lives. Their obligations. Sometimes it might be kids. Who knows what's going on? Did God call the people together? Was Cornelius able to call the people together on a day when they were not working? That's Peter show up at a time where most of the people were off work. It's just interesting to me that God was able providentially to, you've got the trip there, you've got the trip back, and on the day that they come back, when the time comes for Peter to be arriving at the house, everything has lined up very, very well. So if we're, as we look at our culture, interested in having the people who are not that close to us hear the gospel, we should certainly do our best to help those who are near and dear to us to hear the gospel as well. The heart of Cornelius, we have some more information about that as we look at Acts chapter 10 and verse 25. Peter entered and Cornelius meets him. And in my mind, one of the things that Cornelius could have been doing was what? He's in there perhaps visiting with his friends and family members, and to help him know when Peter shows up, what might you do? A man of his authority and position.
Have a servant.
You watch the door. And when somebody knocks, then, you know, either you bring him to me or I'll come see him. But if you look at that first possibility, you just have him brought into me. What would that suggest to you about Cornelius' attitude? He's not all that serious. But if you're there at the door waiting for the guy, friends and family member, perhaps somewhere else in the house, maybe standing there with you, we don't know exactly all the details. Once again, that speaks very, very well of him. It shows some respect. It shows some humility. So Cornelius personally meets Peter, and then he continues to show that respect and humility. What's he do? He falls down at the feet of Peter, and then the text also says he worshipped him. Would you say that would have been strange behavior for a Roman centurion? I mean, this fella has lived long enough where he's achieved some rank, he's used to people showing him respect, some deference, and so forth, and yet this is what he does. I'm not necessarily sure that he saw Peter as a god or anything like that, but he certainly did try to worship Peter. Now, how Cornelius tried to worship Peter, is it stated or not? Yeah. Did he try to kiss his feet? I don't know. There are some details that are simply not given when it comes to that point, but maybe he did try to kiss the feet of Peter or something else. I find that interesting, and if you talk to a Catholic, they will say that this isn't what's going on, and all we can do is take their word for that. But if you look at Catholicism, the old Pope has a ring, and what will people do to it? Kiss the ring. And I think that bishops also have rings, and maybe they're kissed as well. I'm not 100% sure about that, but that sticks in my head as far as... Steve, you know, bishops have rings that are kissed?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking that the bishops also did as well, but I could say that can be looked at a later time. But they say that that's an act of deference. It's not an act of worship, anything like that. Well, it may not be worship. It's getting you at least in that general vicinity, and stay away from that kind of thing. Peter did not take kindly to any of that. He refused to accept any kind of worship. And if you look at the text carefully, Peter doesn't say, oh, get up. What's the text say? He raised him up. Now, that's a small detail, but I find that to be significant. Do you think Cornelius was old and feeble and needed a hand up?
No.
I don't think so. Why do that?
He was appalled.
Well, I think that has to be part of the answer.
Some respect to say, hey, I know better than you.
Yeah, it's just, hey, get up. I also wonder a little bit how gentle that was. I don't imagine Peter just yanked him up, but I don't, at the same time, imagine that was just a general, oh, hey, why don't you stand up?
Well, to ask him to stand up.
Yes.
That was a man that Cornelius would have been.
Yeah, stand up and pull him up a little bit. So he did everything he could to make certain that this fellow understood that he was not someone to be worshipped. Tim?
I think it's kind of interesting that Cornelius, by bending himself down before Peter, he was probably trying to honor Peter, but at the same time, I think mostly he was trying to honor God. He was trying to do everything that he could to please God. And at the same time, Peter's grabbing him under the arm probably and pulling him up and saying, hey, stand up here. And he's doing the same thing. He's trying not to take credit for anything, and he's trying to give God all the credit by saying, hey, I'm just a person like you are. Get up, you know.
Sometimes people try to go the extra mile, maybe because they're good-hearted, maybe because they don't want to make any mistakes. And at this point, it was probably better to err on the side of caution. If you were Cornelius, you had the right attitude, you wanted to do all the right things. All you know is that this holy angel showed up. He scared the fire out of you from what we saw earlier in Acts chapter 10. And now you've got this special person coming to see you. So in my mind, the better safe than sorry route would be you treat this guy with the absolute respect. And in that culture, you did have the Romans bowing down to people. For example, the emperors, they were accustomed to people bowing down. And not that I think Cornelius would have done that, but still being from that kind of culture, it's I'm going to be safe rather than sorry. And if this is wrong, I'll be corrected and then we'll move on from there. So a good heart, certainly. Stan, and then we'll take Lois.
You touched on it, that this, he's a godly man, he's been described as that, and having the angel come and say, you send for Peter, if I were Cornelius, I would be saying to myself, now wait a minute, an angel is telling me to send for this individual, it would automatically put pretty high ranking on Peter. In my
opinion. You might be, with that information he had, you might be thinking that Peter was actually higher than the angel. And if this creature terrified me, what's this guy going to be like? So when we go back and we think about that word which described that fearful suspense, that could have been a mixture. That could have been, I'm not only looking forward to it, but I also have a little fear. And the angel did warn him, everything is okay. Lois?
Verse 26, New American Standard says, but Peter raised him up saying, stand up, I too am just a man.
Okay, thank you for bringing that up, because the word that's used there is anthropos. Anthropology. When Peter says, I'm a man, it's saying we're both human beings, and maybe that ties into the point that Stan was just making. I am not superior to an angel. I'm not even on the level of an angel. You know, we are both human beings, and that's where we need to start the discussion. Tim?
He probably figured Peter's got to be something really, really great, because he already knew that the angel was an angel, and he's figuring, why didn't the angel tell me everything I need to know? Mm-hmm. So he's sending for somebody else that maybe can do a better job of that than the angel can be. And he's thinking, wow, you know.
Yeah. It's like us. When the doc says, I need to send you to somebody else, you know, you're thinking, okay, that has some implications for me as far as seriousness. Let's think about the word worship. There are some people who say that Peter was not worshipped. I don't think that you can make that case very well, though, when you look at the word proskuneo that's used to describe the worship. It's sometimes used to describe false worship, but again, it is used again and again to describe worship. Let's run some cross-references here in connection with that word and also in conjunction with what happened to Peter. Revelation chapter 19, verse 20, and then we'll also run you over to Revelation chapter 22. Steve, we'll ask you to pick up Revelation 19, verse 20. And then we'll flip over to Revelation 22, 8 and 9. Let's take a look at Acts chapter 14, 11 to 15. Acts 14, 11 to 15. All right, Lois, Acts 14:11-15. And then let's head somebody back to the book of Esther. Esther chapter 3, verses 2 through 4. Esther 3, 2, 3, and 4. Ray, you want to get that? Esther 3, 2, 3, and 4. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 19 and verse 20.
Then the beast was captured, and with the false prophet whose work signed in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were cast alive into the lake of burning with fire, burning with brimstone.
Was that 1920?
Yes.
Okay. I gave you a wrong reference. Let's take 22, 8, and 9. Something's not right.
Now I, John, saw and heard these things. And when I heard and saw, I fell down to worship before the beautiful angel who showed me these things. Then he said to me, "See that you do not do that, for I am your fellow servant, and for your brethren the prophets, and for those who keep the word. Words of this book, worship God."
Okay, John fell down before the angel. This was not the only time he did that. And like I say, I apologize for that reference. I checked these things before I come to class. But why we had a problem there?
I think you're looking for 1910.
Was it? Okay, maybe that was it. Yes, thank you. I was trying to do that too. "And I fell down before his feet to worship him, and he saith unto me, See, thou do it not. I am a fellow servant with thee and with thy brethren that hold the testimony of Jesus. Worship God." So thank you very much for that correction. 1910 is the correct reference there. So John does that twice. Why he did that twice? I don't know. Perhaps it was just so overwhelming. Again, maybe he's thinking, let's err on the side of caution. But that's what he did. So when we look at Cornelius, I could say you really can't fault him. Let's take a look at Acts chapter 14, 11 through 15. Paul and Barnabas under consideration here.
"And when the multitude saw what Paul had done, they raised their voice, saying in the," I don't know how to pronounce that, "location?"
Yeah.
Okay. "Voice, language. The gods have become like men and have come down to us. And they began calling Barnabas, Zeus, and Paul, Hermas, because he was the chief speaker. And the priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifice with the crowds. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their robes and rushed out into the crowd, crying out and saying, 'Men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you, and preach the gospel to you in order that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them.'"
Thank you. Now here's a case, two different people, Paul and Barnabas. They're with some people who do not have the correct religious background. And what did I say? The who's come down to see us? The gods. Well, obviously that's not right, and Paul and Barnabas, they tear their clothes and say, once again, just like Peter, "We're men." Don't draw that conclusion about us. That is completely wrong. So when you start looking at these kinds of things, it's not uncommon. And to go back to our Esther reference, we look at this from a slightly different perspective. Ray, Esther chapter 3, verses 2 through 4.
"And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed down and did reverence to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed down not, nor did reverence. Then the king's servants that were in the king's gate said unto Mordecai, 'Why transgressest thou the king's commandment?' Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew."
Thank you. 2 points about that. Number one, the Jews had known for a long time, don't bow in this kind of way to any man. Only God deserves the honor. And in this case, you have Mordecai saying, "I'm not going to do that. It might get me in a peck of trouble, but I'm not going to be willing to do that." And then the other point from Esther 3 would be, there were some people, rulers, who wanted that kind of honor. You bow down to me, you treat me as a god, and in some cases, they wanted to be referred to as a god. when it comes to worship, people have gotten really off track. You think about the fiery serpent back in Numbers chapter 21 and verse 8. Did the people try to worship it? They did. And you find that over in 2 Kings chapter 8 and verse 14. We know that the devil wants worship, Matthew chapter 4 and verse 9. And yet the Bible, Jesus plainly said, Matthew 4:10, only God deserves worship. The Lord did have people fall at his feet. He didn't correct them. The Lord did have people worship him. He didn't reprove them, didn't correct them. But people like Barnabas, Saul, the angel, Revelation 19, Revelation chapter 22, they all said, no worship. Anything that you might add or ask, Trace?
Well, it just makes you think. I mean, it's a show of respect. And even in our country and in England and everywhere else, the girls were taught to curtsy, mm-hmm. and the boys were taught to bow. Or, mm-hmm. Yeah, anyway, and it's a show of greeting and respect. So where do you draw the line between that type of respect?
Yeah. Well, and like I say, that's where Catholicism has drawn the line. They would say that kissing the ring is not worship. It's that sign. The Pope is considered to be the earthly head. And with that definition, then you have a place to begin with them. You can say, okay, no man has that right. Christ has all authority on heaven and earth. And there is no substitute. He's it. So the ring issue, as far as kissing the ring, really becomes a side point because now it's about authority. But in other cases where you can show respect to somebody, there are some things where you have to say, this crosses the line. Now exactly what crosses the line for this person may not be the same thing that crosses the line for this person. But if you are in the realm, and I would say to be on the safe side, anywhere close to the realm of doing something which would somehow be classified or construed as worship, and it's not directed to God, you are on shaky ground at best and very likely sinful ground.
Okay, I do Tai Chi. And at the end of the workouts, if you watch a video, you bow. I don't feel comfortable doing it, but that is how they end the workouts. And I don't know if they're bowing to Mother Nature. I don't know what they're bowing to, but I just
We used to have someone here who was involved with, I'm just going to say karate because I don't know exactly which form it was, but anyway, that's close enough, and was a black belt. And I can remember having a discussion with this person one day, and the individual said, I have gone through all the different degrees, and now I am qualified to be called master. And the person, a Christian, said, I refuse to be called master. Now, that individual, I don't know that they necessarily would have associated anything that was worshipful with that word. But in the person's mind that I'm describing, that was at least kind of headed in that direction. And that was something where the individual just didn't want to go. So I can say, where you draw the line is going to vary from person to person. But once you start getting in that general realm, sphere, you want to be very, very careful. Tim?
Short for master instructor, mm-hmm. is what it is. And when you bow, because that's an Oriental art, it's an Oriental custom, mm-hmm. to bow. That's just showing respect. There's no worship involved in that. And matter of fact, the instructor that I had would say, outside of the gym, the dojong, he would say, don't refer to me as that. I'm Mr. One of the states, Mr. Rose, but that's all that is. It's not, you know, there's no worship involved in that.
Yeah, like I say, for this individual, it was just a place where this person didn't want to go. If you were switching gears here for a second, if you are somewhat familiar with the Masonic Lodge, if you go and you start reading some of their materials, they will have some information in there as far as one of the degrees. I think it's the 33rd degree, worshipful master, and they would say it's not religious and so forth. Worshipful master. It's hard for me to parse it out in any other way than we're now in the sphere of something that is related to worship.
I was going to say, a lot of times, like in the martial arts, using the word master, because a lot of people are not as familiar with it, it seems a little bit more touchy, but you have master of arms, you have master of ceremony, they don't have any problem with that.
Right.
Because they're used to it, so sometimes it's simply you haven't been conditioned.
Yeah. And that's true. Everybody has their own background, sometimes some personal baggage. Some people may be more or less familiar with that. Sometimes people are concerned about the connotation of that, where if it's limited to the gym, that's going to perhaps have a different setting. So, like I say, there are a lot of different factors that come into play. Marcia, did you have a thought too for Stan?
Our grandsons were involved in Taekwondo for a while, and our daughter was questioning about that. But it was a sign of respect and obedience to what that teacher was telling them. And so, I don't know.
Okay. Well, this is one of the reasons why we did the class last week. Teresa asked me why we flipped things around. And the reason for that was, Peter says, I didn't think that we could get through enough of Acts 10 and then have to go through all that. And anyway, but not to rehash the class, but we did make the point last week that there are some titles which are appropriate in some places and maybe more descriptive than anything else. For example, Your Honor. We talked about that as far as being a judge. Officer, doctor, when you see the dentist and so forth. So context is going to have some impact on how we determine what's what and what's right.
I was going to essentially go there too. It's the same as the discussion we had about the word father. It depends on how it's used, etc. But as a bit of a side issue, I couldn't help but think, because I know you were in the military too, what would have happened if you had refused to call Sergeant Master Sergeant? Mm-hmm. It creates some really interesting situations.
It does, but there was nothing that the person who had that designation considered to be an act of worship. I certainly, when I referred to somebody as Master Sergeant, never had anything in mind as far as worship, but those were titles or designations to help us understand a function or position. Virginia? I had one in town, and like I say, the books, for a number of years, they were supposed to be secret. They were supposed to...
Yeah. They were supposed to tell them, but he said there was a lot of scripture.
It is. If you were to talk to one, and there's actually one that I talk to from time to time, and he's probably divulged some things that he shouldn't have, but anyway, he's talked about the fact that as far as one of the degrees, they reenact the Lord's Supper. Now the question becomes, if it is not in any sense a religious organization, why on earth would you reenact the Lord's Supper? There's information in the books about Solomon's Temple and so forth, and I could say a lot of things. If you look at, again, I think it's the 32nd or 33rd degree, the Masonic ring, you should see a G on it. Well, what do you think the G stands for? Good?
God.
So when you start looking at things and you start looking at the books, it's laced with religion. The rituals, even in death. Yeah. And that's true for a lot of people who have come out.